Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And I am back with my next guest, Jennifer Lang. I'm so happy to welcome her to the program to talk about her book, Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Patsy. Thank you for having me.
Shalom. So you are in America right now?
I am in the San Francisco Bay Area at the end of another book tour and seeing family.
When I first heard about this micro memoir idea, I was intrigued, and you have just pulled it off so beautifully. There are so many things I like about this book, and you do things in this book. You include things like charts and other things in the book that it's quite unusual. So I thought when they decided to publish you that you had this concept which is different, and it looks different as we're reading it. I think it's brilliant.
Thank you. I call it, without, for lack of a better word, I call it experimental prose. I don't know if that's what it is. I really created it just kind of after seeing small publishers say in their submission guidelines, open to experimental prose. It started there. I was like, wow, I wonder what that means. And I fell down a rabbit hole, but it's almost like it wasn't an already existing rabbit hole. It was my own. I did this on my own. And well, the publisher saw it with some of it, some of the experimentation, and liked it. And then once I got the feedback, you know, it was an offer of publication with, we love what you're doing, I was like, I'm going to do more before I have to submit the final manuscript. So that's what that is.
Well, I have to explain to people, it's unusual in a book to have sort of sentences stuck out from the regular, you know, lineup of paragraphs and charts. And I thought it was so clever, and really it enhanced the book so much, because I get a lot of memoirs, I get so many of them, and you know, they're always interesting to read, but with this experimental method, I thought you really added some depth to it.
Well, thank you.
Explain your story, because it's fascinating. You've had quite a journey through life.
Okay. Based in California, California-born and raised parents, rooted. I grew up really, really rooted. I knew who I was. I was a Northern California Reform Jew. And that said, in my childhood, so we had affiliation with a synagogue, Reform, and youth group and camp, and these things really shaped me. But we also had what most people in the 70s in our Reform world did not have, especially in California, which was close ties to Israel. So I had a great aunt and a great uncle who came with my grandmother and another three siblings from Romania to San Francisco in the 1930s and with their parents. And in 1947, two of them left, arriving in pre-state Israel in 1948. So my first trip to Israel was 5. So we made these trips during my childhood, really traveling at a time when people just didn't do travel like that. But let me back up. Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature, is a love story with a lot of conflict, inner and personal, marital and geopolitical, about home. It starts in 1989 when I meet my French husband in the hills of Jerusalem, and ends in 2011 when we make our final return, our third time back to Israel to try and live there with three kids. We left in 1994 with one baby. We returned in 2007 for 1 year with three kids in school. We left again. We returned in 2011 with three kids, one who went into the army and two into school. So it was a lot of movement, a tremendous amount of movement for two people who couldn't agree on home. So the fact that I grew up really rooted, in contrast to that, is like I kind of look back sometimes. I'm 58, and I still look back and I think, what happened? But I think what happened was growing up other in a small city called Piedmont in Northern California, other as Jews in a very, very non-Jewish place, not religious, not God-fearing, but culturally, with Eastern European grandparents from Russia and Romania in San Francisco. And I think my sibling and I always felt it. I mean, it was hard to avoid. My mom started coming into my classroom in kindergarten every Hanukkah. She came in with a menorah, candles, the story of Hanukkah, a griddle, and the dough for the potato pancakes. And she would light the candles, and she would say the blessing. And she was not religious, my mom. And she would make potato pancakes and pass them out with applesauce and sour cream and share the story of Hanukkah to share our differences. But nobody else's mom was coming in to share the story of Christmas. Probably around third or fourth grade said, enough, stop. So we grew up other. We grew up different. And I think that's really the root of it.
That contrasts with your husband's background. Explain a little bit where he came from.
So my husband is from Alsace, France, from Strasbourg. We're both from Ashkenazi backgrounds, so Eastern European Jewry. He grew up, if you ask him how he grew up as a Jew, he will answer, I just grew up Jewish, whereas I say I grew up Reform, because in America we have boxes and labels. In France, they really don't. He grew up as a Jew who grew up keeping kosher, separating milk and meat, meals and dishes. The kitchen was always kosher. When they ate out in non-kosher restaurants, they never ate non-kosher meat. They never ate shellfish. They lit the candles and said the prayers for the wine and the challah bread on every Friday night and Saturday for Shabbat. He went to synagogue every Friday night with his dad and his brother and his mom. His mom always sat separately because women and men were divided. He grew up traditional. And so when you bring that amount of tradition into America, which is where we lived for most of our 16 years raising kids, it translates into modern orthodoxy. So a completely different beast, if you will, from the way I was raised. It's where your religion, your Judaism, is your lifestyle. So our kids went to modern Orthodox schools. We were in modern Orthodox synagogues. And every 7 days, our family life was very intense and focused around going to synagogue and being with friends who did what we did. Very community-oriented. That's the part I loved. But it was not a given to take that on because I didn't have the belief. I didn't believe in God. I couldn't just jump in and say, oh, yeah, I'll do it your way, which he asked me when we were 23, with pleasure. I said, I'll do it your way, but I kind of kicked and screamed the whole way.
So it is a different lifestyle when you honor Shabbat. Your life changes in so many ways when you do that. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We would eat in non-kosher restaurants, but I had to always read menus first to make sure there were enough vegetarian options. We never took the car from Friday sundown until Saturday sundown. We never spent money. We never turned on and off lights, used electricity. We did all the cooking Friday afternoon for the next 25 hours. It's intense. If you aren't raised with it or if you don't believe in it, it is intense. And there's a beauty to it. I just probably didn't see the beauty when I was in it.
But you met in Israel. So the two of you met in Israel, which in itself is a fascinating experience. Of course, you went to Israel when you were a child, but then when you got a little older and you started going around the country, there were some things that were really surprising about Israeli behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I got older, so I became more aware. Culturally, there's a lot of differences. I mean, we could say that, you know, you can go country to country and observe the cultures. By the time I went back at 23, it was after living in Paris. My mom put me in a French class when I was 6, an experiment in our community, and I stayed almost my entire childhood. I studied French. So I did my junior year abroad in Paris. I wasn't 100% fluent. I dreamed of fluency. So after college, I, by stroke of luck, found a job in the Jewish community in Paris, 21 years old, independent financially, worked on the Champs-Élysées in a Jewish non-political organization, but and legal. They got me work papers. But my boss and I did not care for each other. That's a nice way of saying it. And I knew my time there was limited. And I couldn't stay in the country if I wasn't legal. I really mastered French. I was in the job for a year and a half, and I quit mid-year. I quit in February 1989. And at that point, I decided I was done living abroad. I was ready to go back to America, and I was on my way to graduate school, waiting for rejection letters, acceptance letters, which would come that spring. And I decided to spend those intervening months, March through August, in Israel, where my sibling had immigrated and some really, really close friends were doing different things there. And so the last thing my mom said to me before I got on that plane was, whatever you do, don't fall in love and stay. Because I think she had two friends whose daughters had done that. And I promised her, but you should never promise. I promised my mom exactly what she wanted to hear. And 5 weeks after I got there, I met Philippe through a mutual French friend. And, broke my promise. Very quickly broke my promise.
When you went back, of course, one of the things I remember, the first time for an American, you go to Israel and of course you have expectations and ideas, but I will never forget the first time I had to catch a bus. I am always early for everything. So I had to catch a bus, at 6 a.m. and I was there at 5:30 and I'm standing in the spot where the bus is going to, open their doors, pull up and open their doors. And I'm standing there and, I don't move. I've got my bag, in those days, a big suitcase. We didn't have rolling bags even then. And then the bus pulls up out of nowhere. All of these people just rush right past me, get on the bus. Nobody cares about that. I'm a silly American girl with this too big suitcase. I am the last one to get on that bus. Nobody helped me. Nobody cared because they weren't going to get at those seats. Eventually, I got on and I'm standing. I was trying to figure out, how did they do that? And I thought they were so rude. But then later on, I learned that's just sort of the Israeli way.
I was going to say, so the Israeli way, I think, is summed up in one word, which many people know in America, which is chutzpah and, nerve. But I think there's good chutzpah and there's bad chutzpah. And
yeah.
I've come to admire the good chutzpah. And I think it's definitely shaped me as an adult, for sure. Between Israeli chutzpah and the way my mom raised me, with the mottos my mom raised me with, I would say we were out to dinner with my closest childhood friend, our parents, best friends in college. She says to me last night, "You're so fearless." And I thought, yeah, I think I learned that from home. But I think I've also gotten it from living in Israel.
You do get that from living in Israel. So
yeah.
Let's go back a little bit to this idea of you wrote a memoir, and it was sort of regular length, the typical, like what was it, 60,000 words, 70,000 words.
Oh,
how
no,
did you just...
It's really atypical. It's 14,000.
Well, no, the new one. But the original one, when you originally started writing, you didn't intend to write. It's what,
correct.
120 pages, I think? It's like something like that, which is not typical.
Right. So So 7 years ago, I had a 95,000-word manuscript.
Ooh.
That I had finished, and I hated. I couldn't even turn the page. I was so bored. I mean, nothing about it. Not the word choice, the sentence structure, the narrative arc, the story, nothing. It just didn't work. But I hired what's called a developmental editor to help me shape it. And she gave me amazing feedback, really helpful. But the main thing she said to me was, don't try to work on it now. Put it away for a while. Let everything sink in. And I put it away. And I put it away for probably 4 months. And then, that's where my story really starts. I put it away for 4 months, and at some point during those 4 months, I took a class online, flash class. A lot of people know the expression flash fiction, but I'm nonfiction. So for me, I was writing everything true from my life in Israel. And it was, 24 like complete strangers, virtual. This is before the days of COVID, so we didn't talk about synchronous and asynchronous time, but it was asynchronous. And the feedback I got from a lot of people who read my work was, wow, it's fascinating. I hope you're writing a memoir in flash about your life in Israel. So I would say the seed for this short writing was planted there. But it still took years. And what ended up happening is that 95,000-word manuscript has been cut and really reshaped into two. And it turns out that unintentionally, Places We Left Behind is part one. And on October 15th, 2024, Part two is coming out. Part two starts in 2011, where this story ends, and it's called Landed, A Yogi's Memoir in Pieces and Poses. Yoga plays a big part of both books. Yoga is a big part of my journey. It was so unintentional. The second manuscript is three times longer. So the first one ended up as 14,000 words, and the second one is about 45,000 words.
But still short, even for a memoir.
The press that I am working with, Vine Leaves Press, I knew they published short books because I had read No Place on Any Map and Postcards from Here. Postcards from Here, I think, is Penny Gissinger. No Place on Any Map is... this is terrible to not have the name come to me. And I had read these books. And so Vine Leaves Press at the time called them Collection of Vignettes. So that I knew to approach them because I knew they published these short books. It helps, you know, you got to do the research to know.
You're right. Not every publisher would go for it. They really don't.
Correct.
So many don't want anything out of the ordinary. I mean, they don't want, if it's a printed book, they don't want drop caps. I mean, they're really set in their ways in many respects. So that you have one who is willing to work with this experimental format, and then to see how really well it worked. As I was going through it, I said, this is sort of startling. Sometimes I would say, wow, she's got this in here. She's moved this sentence to this side, and she's doing... I enjoyed that so much.
I think the
surprise of it helped always to create that you wanted to get, you know, beyond and keep reading.
Thank you. Something that's like a pet peeve for me as a reader. So I, as a memoir writer, I love reading a good novel. Love, especially historical fiction. But one of my greatest pet peeves, like the older I get, the more I read, the more I write, I've really come, like the quicker I'll put a book away when a writer repeats information, like dumbing down the reader, thinking a reader can't remember from an earlier chapter some key piece of information and just keeps repeating it chapter by chapter. I can't stand that. So if you remember, you might not remember, but there's a chapter called, and I call them now chapterettes. I had been in conversation at Zibby's bookshop in Santa Monica last week, and I was in conversation with a writer, Blair Glazer, and she called them chapterettes, and I'm like, oh God, I love that. So that's my new word for what I've done, chapterettes.
I love it. There's too.
One, right? Creative. There's one called coordinates, and I give real coordinates of two different places on the map, and they're real, and it doesn't matter that the reader knows where they are. It's irrelevant because the reader understands towards the end of the book that they are probably one in America and one in Israel. The reader will understand it. And so I couldn't bear, once again, you know, on page whatever it was, to say the same thing over and over. I can't stand it. And so I figured out, like, how to show it differently. So that's also a lot of why I did what I did.
There's a freshness. What's cute is I'm listening to you. You do sound so Northern Californian. I know you're not a teenager anymore, but you have that vibe of that. There's a certain sound to Northern California.
I've been told
girl.
I sound really young. I think that's what you're trying to say, which is really nice because I'm 60 in a year and a half. So that's really, really nice to hear. But another word people have used I've used this word. I call it experimental prose, playful. Playful prose. So another way to say what I've done is I've created this, whatever, an unconventional text that's very playful, which mirrors my marriage. So while my marriage, we had some really hard years, like over two decades of hard, because we couldn't agree on where to live and how Jewish to be. So those are the essence of the conflict. Our marriage has always been playful. A lot of flirtation, a lot of game playing. From the moment we met, we've been playing games. It started with backgammon. We carry a deck of cards everywhere we go so we can play gin rummy, gin. And we have a group of friends we play code names with. So that playfulness, I also really like it because, first of all, I think otherwise the conflict, the strife in the marriage just, like, is too heavy. So I feel like it lightens it a little bit. And it mirrors the marriage.
It really, really works. And I am so looking forward to having you back in October. And we will be talking about book two of your... memoir of your life, which is fascinating. Like you, I come from a background where I never expected that I would become a world traveler, actually, until I was 11, when I decided to move to England. And I followed up on that. And 10 years later, I was living in England, and I had bought a house. So it's so exciting to discover somebody who's done a lot of things. I really, it's just, I love it. All your stories are fascinating. And I think every reader for this book will want to read the next one.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me for the conversation.
Well, it's been great. Now, you have a website you want people to go to?
I would love it. So it's IsraelWritersStudio.com. Writers Studio is just one S. And you see my book information. You see my, I teach creative writing in Israel. I sometimes teach online. That information's there. My shorter pieces, which have all been published, are there. Thank you so much. I'm also on Facebook, Jennifer Friedman Lang.
I think what you've done here is, in many ways, it's really groundbreaking. And I just compliment you so much on it. It's really wonderful. And your story is fascinating. I just got a kick out of this book. Again, thank you for joining me today. You will be back. Jennifer Lang, you're fascinating. The book is great. It's called Places We Left Behind, a memoir in miniature. And you can find it online, and you can go also to Jennifer's Facebook and website. But thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Jennifer. It was really a joy to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.